This is a Woodlawn bound for local train. The next stop is 167th Street.
Introduction. Jerome Avenue is a bustling commercial and transit corridor in the Southwest Bronx. Running along Jerome Avenue is the 4 train, an elevated subway taking people in and out of the borough. On any given day of the week, along each stop, hundreds of people are buying groceries for dinner, picking up their children from school, meeting friends, or having small talk with business owners and salespeople. Populated by grocery stores, Spanish restaurants, clothing stores, meat markets, discount stores, and auto shops, just about every need for a resident is covered. The area's landscape, however, stands to undergo large changes throughout the decade, under the guise of improving the lives of its residents. On March 22, 2018, New York City Council passed the Jerome Avenue rezoning, an upzoning that sought to increase housing and commercial density along the corridor. This measure informed city activists' reaction to future city rezonings, most namely the Inwood rezoning and the Southern Boulevard rezoning, the first of which was held up in courts until late 2020, and the second of which was canceled altogether. In this podcast, I will first analyze what occurred in the Jerome Avenue rezoning and why. After this, I will describe the primary issues that arose out of the rezoning and what changes are likely to occur based on other city rezonings. Then, I will highlight 5 possible policy solutions to improve the lives and conditions of the residents and business owners whose livelihoods operate around and depend on Jerome Avenue.
This is a Woodlawn bound for local train. The next stop is 170th Street.
Neighborhood description. The specific blocks highlighted in the rezoning area are home to nearly 50,000 residents. In the encompassing Bronx Community Districts 4 and 5, nearly 280,000 residents live within the area, 42.9% of which are foreign-born. BCD 4 and 5 are composed of 9 neighborhoods, including Mount Eden, Highbridge, Concourse Village, Morrisania, West and East Concourse, Morris Heights, Mount Hope, and University Heights. Served by 2 subway lines, the elevated 4 train and the underground D train, and 10 bus routes, transit is an essential factor to the populace of the region. Along with major public transportation routes, the Cross Bronx Expressway and Major Deegan Expressway intersect of Jerome Avenue around Mount Eden, another contributor to the present auto industry. Jerome Avenue is the commercial companion to the primarily residential nearby Grand Concourse, famous for its swaths of large apartment buildings. As mentioned previously, a countless array of small and chain businesses are present along the avenue. Frequently present are grocers, pharmacies, discount stores, florists, specialty grocers including meat markets, fish markets, and viveros, along with restaurants, clothing stores, and electronic supply stores. Most notable are the auto repair and auto supply shops, cementing Jerome Avenue status as the auto corridor of the Bronx. Similar to many of the other sites highlighted for rezoning, Jerome Avenue is a primarily low-income community of color. According to the New York City Planning Community District profiles for Bronx Community Districts 4 and 5, the districts in which the rezoning is located, 67.6% of residents are Hispanic, while 27.9% are Black. Compared to citywide and Bronx-wide statistics, the economic differences become even more apparent. In BCD 4 and 5, 34% of residents live in poverty. The citywide average of residents living in poverty is 19.8%, while the Bronx-wide average is 24.4%. In addition, for Bronx Community Districts 4 and 5, 56% of residents are rent-burdened, while citywide this percentage is 44.2%, and Bronx-wide it is 50.9%. Lastly, the yearly median household income for residents of BCDs 4 and 5 is $20,000 per year, while the median household income citywide is $57,000, and Bronx-wide it is $39,000. This paints a picture of a neighborhood with residents at a great economic disadvantage, depending on community ties more strongly as a result.
This is a Woodlawn bound for local train. The next stop is Mount Eden Avenue.
Background on the rezoning. Jerome Avenue, along with 15 other neighborhoods, was highlighted as a possible site for rezoning in Bill de Blasio's first term. The rezoning followed the trends of upzonings done throughout Mayor Bloomberg's administration. The rezoning was to be a part of the Housing New York plan championed by de Blasio. This is seen in the primary reasoning given for the rezoning by the New York City Department of Planning, of Jerome Avenue being transit-rich but housing-starved. Housing New York seeks to add 300,000 additional affordable housing units to the city by 2026, with 3,250 of these units being located around Jerome Avenue. The narrative painted this area, as much of the Bronx, as an area of underutilized potential. The specific rezoning area is along Jerome Avenue from 165th Street to 184th Street. extending for a few blocks eastward and westward along each subway stop. The previous zoning of Jerome Avenue was either exclusively residential, commercial, or light-use industrial. Along the avenue directly, areas were zoned as either commercial or light-use industrial, leading to the proliferation of the auto industry. Areas were zoned as residential mostly along the avenue's cross streets, usually as R5 or R6, meaning buildings could be between 3 to 11 stories in height. After the rezoning, most of the avenue was zoned as R7A, R7D, R8A, R9A, and CD4D, along with commercial overlays. The lowest yielding of these is R7A, allowing residential buildings to be 13 stories in height. The highest yielding of these is R9A, which allows for the building of residential buildings between 16 to 17 stories in height. Of particular note, the largest commercial hub of the region, Burnside Avenue, is zoned as CD4D, meaning it is an already densely built area that acquires more traffic than nearby commercial areas, typically containing department stores, some office space, and theaters. A major concern cited by community activists during public hearings included fear of displacement of existing renters and owners. Since rezonings promote residential density, which increases property values, they carry the potential to displace longtime residents who cannot afford the resulting higher rents and property taxes. Another telling factor in de Blasio-era rezonings is the fact that they are all located in low-density and low-income neighborhoods. Fernando Torrado gives more background on this trend.
We know that in the Bloomberg administration, you know, they deliberately downzoned a number of communities to preserve low density, to preserve home ownership, and to preserve neighborhood character, and select upzonings that were occurring in neighborhoods like Long Island City to increase their land value. In the de Blasio administration, and supposedly with the Jerome Avenue rezoning, you know, there was always the concern of why are you upzoning poor neighborhoods to put more affordable housing, supposedly, when we don't even have the services to take care of folks who are living there now.
Right.
And then there was also the additional fear that, oh, well, the housing isn't being created for us. It's being created for people who are being displaced from other parts of the city due to gentrification.
Unlike low-density, high-income neighborhoods, its residents do not typically have the means, resources, time, and influence to protest new city measures. Another concern from residents was the potential strain that increased density would put on the neighborhood. On any given workday, traffic is already extremely congested in the area, and construction crews, along with more residents, serve to worsen these conditions. In addition, the loss of rent-stabilized and lower-rent apartments is increasingly likely in rezoned neighborhoods. In their 2019 report on the Williamsburg/Greenpoint and Park Slope Brooklyn rezonings of the early 2000s, the organization Churches United for Fair Housing found that both neighborhoods lost an estimated 2,412 rent-stabilized units post-rezoning. This poses a concern for both recently rezoned neighborhoods and rezonings in the works, as they largely contain older, pre-war buildings that are either rent-stabilized or contain lower rents due to their condition. Churches United also highlights the racialized aspect of rezoning, as residents of color are more likely to be low income. Another shocking statistic they found is a decrease of 15,000 Black and Latino residents in Greenpoint and Williamsburg from 2000 to 2015, despite an overall population increase of 20,000 to the area. While rezoned neighborhoods are indeed generating more economic activity and housing, as shown by the numbers, longstanding residents are not typically the ones who reap the benefits. These concerns were also echoed by Joan Byron, who warns of the displacement of lower-income residents by higher-income residents.
I think in almost every case, including Jerome, residential displacement was number one, mm-hmm. because people rightly pointed out that even, you know, the affordability levels that would be achieved through MIH were gonna demand much higher incomes than current residents.
Right.
The rezoned areas would have. So the affordable housing was not going to be affordable to people who now lived in the rezoned areas.
Lastly, all rezonings done by the city are not strictly upzoning. In fact, the majority of upzonings occur in low-income neighborhoods of color, while downzonings occur in high-income and generally wider neighborhoods. This creates an effect in which the city's mantra of increasing density and building more housing is in conflict. Whose neighborhoods are upzoned, which leaves residents to mitigate the effects on their housing, environment, and livelihoods, is determined by their income level. This leaves the city's poorest residents at the mercy of the government, left of piecemeal concessions from both city and developers who do not always serve their best interests.
This is a Woodlawn bound for local train. The next stop is 176th Street.
The results of the Jerome Avenue rezoning were in some ways both slow and immediate. In 2018 and until late 2019, many developers bought lots and buildings along the rezoned avenue in an attempt to cash in on speculated land value. According to research conducted by Jenna Davis, based on data from the NYC Department of City Planning, the NYC Department of Investigation, and the NYC Department of Housing Preservation and Development, property values increased dramatically in the years after the rezoning. From 2015 to 2020, Davis found that property values along the Jerome Avenue corridor increased by 241%, with residential property values increasing by 146%, and commercial property values increasing by 44%. Taking advantage of programs such as mandatory inclusionary housing and the 421A tax program, which I will discuss in detail later, residential and commercial developers are able to create large, 17 or more story buildings at a subsidized cost. Local residents are heavily aware of the changes to the built environment, many of them impossible to ignore, like the two 17-story apartment buildings under construction near 167th Street Station on the 4 train. As seen in recent years, due to higher property values, existing landlords are incentivized to take various actions. These include raising their tenants' rents, with the intent of driving out existing tenants in order to collect higher rents from more lucrative tenants, or selling their buildings, either to other landlords or to developers. In the case of the first scenario, these changes are already seen along the avenue. While there are few commercial vacancies, the ones that are present are quite noticeable, in the midst of an active economic environment. One example is the three commercial vacancies along 167th Street and Jerome Avenue, the only stores for rent on the block, suggesting that the tenants were pushed out by the landlord. Also, as a result of the increased rents at areas of higher foot traffic, it is more likely for chain stores to be present at the head of stations. In the case of the second scenario, many single-story or multifamily houses nearby the avenue, especially in the rezoned blocks along Edward L. Grant Highway, are either listed for sale or in the process of being demolished, presumably to build larger apartment buildings.
There's been a significant amount of, I guess you might say, the consumption of low-density residential construction, single-family homes, being bought and redeveloped as multi-unit housing. So there will be, in effect, a conversion of single-family homes into multi-story residential buildings. So there's been a concern about the increase in density.
In addition, as mentioned in the book Zoned Out, new construction results in landlords raising the rents of surrounding older buildings, regardless of the amount of affordable housing units. For example, as of 2019, the median rent along the Jerome Avenue rezoning site was $1,177. A newly built apartment complex charging $1,800 a month for a one-bedroom would signal to nearby landlords the rent some are willing to pay in that same neighborhood. Consequently, landlords of the older building may choose to raise their rent up to $1,400, making up the difference because they see the potential for higher profits and to cover higher property taxes.
Vernacular, naturally occurring rental housing on the next block had been running for $700 or $800 a month. Those rents are going to rise,
right?
You know, to whatever level the new market will bear. And, you know, the city, in its analysis, the administration would say, well, don't worry, their rents stabilize. And as the community organizations, especially CASA and Northwest Bronx, knew perfectly well, there were a million ways for property owners to, you know, to move units out of rent stabilization.
A major win of the rezoning, which was not directly passed with the package, however actively pushed for by activists, was the Right to Counsel legislation passed by New York City Council in August of 2018. This law provided residential tenants with a right to legal counsel in the event of an eviction case being brought to them by their landlord. This greatly discouraged the amount of illegal eviction trials brought forth by landlords, and this in combination with the eviction moratorium that went into effect of 2020, helped curb displacement and evictions in the years since. In high-need neighborhoods that initially qualified for the service, evictions decreased by 20% from 2017 to 2019. Also, 85% of tenants who receive legal counsel as a result of the law managed to evade eviction. In addition, the implementation of the worst evictors list helped effectively shame landlords for needless evictions.
It's also a huge deterrent to other landlords from bringing eviction cases, because it used to just be a gimme, you know, it used to just, like, you didn't even have to go in front of the judge, you could just find the tenant in the hall and say, hey, you know, you're toast, yeah. Like, let's cut a deal. And this totally reversed that. This meant, you know, a landlord had to, like, put up a real fight and find an honest rationale in the law for going forward with an eviction. So it immensely deterred landlords from even starting eviction proceedings.
Another win for activists and tenant organizers was the use of a mandatory inclusionary zoning, meaning that all new buildings created would be required to have affordable units. In addition, in some cases, activists were able to have developers agree to reserve a percentage of units for disadvantaged groups, including the homeless, the elderly, those who live in nearby shelters, those with disabilities and mobility issues, and single-parent households. However, as I will later get into, the promise of affordable housing often falls short.
This is a Woodlawn bound for local train. The next stop is Burnside Avenue.
Community documentation. I began my community documentation by observing the landscape of Jerome Avenue and taking photographs of especially notable projects or circumstances. Here, I saw multiple projects under construction, including new apartment buildings, mixed-use residential buildings, health facilities, and schools. The commercial vacancies I noticed were either directly at the train stations or among auto shops along the avenue. During this process, I spoke to stakeholders, including those who are currently working or residing in the area. I asked people on the street if they were residents of the area, about their experiences renting, and if they noticed any changes during their time living in the neighborhood. Some of the main concerns listed among renters included the high cost of rent, which many stated increased despite job losses during the pandemic, and confusion towards housing lotteries of the new buildings in the neighborhood. This aligned with the six major concerns listed by residents of BCB 4 and 5 in the Jerome Avenue Health Plan, which were education, food environment, healthcare quality and access, housing, local economic development, and public outdoor spaces.
The Jerome rezoning isn't going to look at social issues like crime and unemployment, right. But it should, right? It should consider how it's going to make the quality of life of residents, or improve the quality of life of residents in exchange for this rezoning, right? The need for community space has been a huge demand. They have some, but it's certainly not enough.
I also visited small businesses and asked owners a series of 10 questions revolving around their experiences. They also expressed frustration with constant construction, starting early in the morning and extending through the day, contributing to the already heavy noise pollution of the area and traffic congestion. Lastly, they told me about the many changes in the neighborhood in the past decade, including the building of new apartments, schools, and new businesses. These questions included how long they were in business, what a typical day was like for them, how busy they were now versus pre-pandemic, if they owned or rented their space, if they lived in the area, what changes they noticed in the neighborhood, what their biggest challenges were running the business, and lastly, how they feel the city and federal government could help. The main concerns listed by small business owners included the current inflation crisis, struggles with making rent, and competition with chains and online businesses. The struggles of paying rent is especially intriguing, as most of the business owners stated the stores were consistently busy, even when compared to pre-pandemic levels. Despite the relative success, the high cost of rent still pose a large challenge to owners and cut into their operational costs and profits. In response to my last question on government assistance, many businesses stated that they received small business relief funds during the pandemic from the federal government, but no city assistance. These concerns are echoed in a 2021 City Limits article from writers Daniel Pera and S.A. Olomhante, which found that $1.5 million of city funds set aside for small businesses affected by the Jerome Avenue rezoning has yet to be received by auto business owners. In addition, Kenneth Brown speaks to these concerns in his experience as district manager of Bronx Community Board 5.
Accessing the various government reliefs for small business has been a problem because typically the documentation thresholds that are asked in these grant applications, a lot of these small businesses don't keep relatively robust bookkeeping. So when there are the government grants for COVID relief for small businesses, a lot of our businesses couldn't take advantage of that because they're not technically sufficiently technically sophisticated to produce the documentation. So a minority of our businesses were able to avail themselves of the paycheck protection and things like that.
When asked what the government could do to improve their position, business owners stated another stimulus or hope that the cost of rent and taxes would be most beneficial. I also conducted my community documentation by reaching out to key informants involved in various processes of the rezoning. I had the pleasure of speaking with Joan Byron, a longtime Bronx activist and program director at the Neighborhood First Fund. I also spoke with Fernando Torrado, the director of new initiatives at the New York City Department of Health and Mental Hygiene. Lastly, I spoke with Kenneth Brown, the current district manager of Bronx Community Board 5. Each key informant gave me a different perspective on the Jerome Avenue rezoning process and the interests of stakeholders today. Joan Byron spoke on Bronx activist concerns and efforts during city hearings before the rezoning went into effect. In addition, she spoke about the shift of focus in the wake of the passage of the Right to Counsel law, which she cites as a major win on the behalf of tenant organizers. Fernando Torrado spoke on the importance of public health and the role of the Jerome Avenue Public Health Task Force, an organization he was a part of that sought to, quote, address key community health priorities, including healthy food access, air quality and environmental health, access to health care, and construction mitigation strategies in response to the rezoning. Some of these solutions include the building of more community centers, hospitals, and health facilities, and green spaces such as parks. Kenneth Brown spoke about the concerns of business owners and renters in the years since the rezoning, and particularly the unique set of challenges they face as a result of the pandemic. He mentioned several projects that Bronx Community Board 5 intends to work on to help business owners, like offering legal assistance and educational attainment programs.
This is a Woodlawn bound for local train. The next stop is 183rd Street.
Policy solutions. So what options are left for residents and business owners? As seen in other renowned New York City rezonings, higher capacity rates on land and real estate speculation overwhelmingly take hold in rezoned neighborhoods. Multiple policy solutions propose protections and alternative options for renters and small business owners. MIH reform. Mandatory inclusionary housing, or otherwise simply referred to as MIH, is a program launched in 2016 born out of the de Blasio administration. The goal of the policy is to secure permanent affordable housing in newly built residential buildings by requiring developers to set aside at least 30% of their units for low-income residents. The income levels for affordable housing are determined based on the area median income, which are income levels set by the Federal Department of Housing and Urban Development. These income levels are often based on a city's metro area, including nearby affluent suburbs along with the city itself. What results is an overinflated median income that does not reflect the economic realities of many low-income city residents. As of 2022, the New York City AMI for a single-person household is $93,400 per year. As mentioned previously, the citywide average median income is $57,000 per year, while the average median income for residents living near Jerome Avenue is $20,000 per year. This creates a large disparity as to who can actually obtain affordable housing units versus who needs them the most. In the case of Jerome Avenue, some protections do exist to ensure that affordable units in newly built buildings do go to local residents. For example, law requires that at least 50% of affordable housing units built under MIH go to residents living within the community district. In addition, an essential part of the ULURP process that every developer has to go through is a hearing by the district's community board. During these hearings, concerns are raised by locals and members of the board, often leading to important concessions being made by the developers.
Where the community board, I think, is most robust and pertinent is, you know, developers have to present their projects through the housing committee and then ultimately a vote by the board to approve. So there's an opportunity for negotiation. And for example, we've had developers come in and by the course of conversation in the committee, they've switched the mix of apartments, they've added more senior apartments, they've switched studios for one bedrooms. So there has been an impact, I think a significant impact by community engagement at that through that process.
This at least ensures that representatives of the community have a say in the process. However, still requires strong negotiating with private developers that can be avoided somewhat if important reforms to MIH were made. First and foremost, one of the most important changes to the current MIH system would be a change in how AMI is calculated. Being confronted with the requirements for affordable housing is often a major shock to those who need it. And for these high income requirements to be present in housing, but not present in other social welfare programs like WIC is unfair. AMI should be calculated at a more localized level, preferably by community district. This would make the most sense in New York City, as community districts are a unique and unchanging feature of the city's geopolitical landscape, unlike congressional districts and state senate districts. In addition, community districts are grouped by generally related neighborhoods, meaning it is more likely for residents to move within their community district when applying for affordable housing units. A localized approach to AMI would allow for the city's poorest and most in-need residents to obtain housing through the lotteries, rather than being an empty promise and prospect that is unattainable.
That is the key to, I think, a lot of the issues related to affordable housing. That's something that I've been concerned about, you know, making the AMI more granular. That's something that I've thought is necessary for decades. Yeah. That's come up in, like I said, these housing committee meetings where people complain about, you know, the area median income not being appropriate. You know, 30% AMI in the Upper East Side is different than here.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, so I think making a more granular AMI would go a long way.
Along with this change to how AMI is calculated, there should be leniency on the income requirements for apartment units. Oftentimes, applicants find themselves disqualified from attaining a unit because they make a few dollars over the income requirement. This leaves out many residents from the process and disincentivizes those chosen in the housing lotteries from going through the process again. Another reform to MIH that would benefit residents of Jerome Avenue is requiring developers to set aside a higher number of units to affordable housing, and to require those units to go to those who are on the lower spectrum of the area median income. When looking at recent opened housing lotteries for buildings along Jerome Avenue, the issue of the non-specificity of MIH policy becomes apparent. In a housing lottery notice posted in November of 2021 for 1769 Jerome Avenue, about 35% of the 16-story mixed-use building's units were designated for affordable housing. Out of 175 units, 60 units were available through the Housing Connect lottery. Of these 60 affordable units, 35 units were available to those making 60% of the AMI, and 25 were available to those making 80% of the AMI, a range of eligible incomes from $34,000 per year to $118,000 per year. While the most amount of units were available for those at the lower end of the AMI, the lowest income level is still $14,000 higher than the median income of Bronx Community Districts 4 and 5. In addition, the more space in a unit, the higher the eligible income level must be. This excludes the needs of low-income families and single parents who may need the space of a one- or two-bedroom, however may only be eligible for a studio apartment. In another housing lottery posted in May of 2021 for 1325 Jerome Avenue, a 21-story mixed-use building, 101 units were available through Housing Connect. The eligible incomes range from roughly $25,000 per year to $88,000 per year for residents making between 40 to 60% of the AMI. However, unlike the previous lottery, the most amount of units were reserved for those making the higher percentage of the AMI. 68 units were reserved for those making 60% of the AMI, 13 units were reserved for those making 50% of the AMI, and only 8 units were reserved for those making 40% of the AMI. Numerically, the residents most likely to need affordable housing making the least amount of the AMI were left to compete for a small number of units. The best way to benefit residents most in need would be to increase the amount of units designated for affordable housing from 30 to 50%, along with making the distribution of units scaled so that the most units would go towards making the lowest percentage of the AMI.
I think a really modest reform that folks have talked about is, A, like to just up the requirement, you know, like to acknowledge the reality that the program is an incredible giveaway to developers,
right.
And that they could, you know, they could afford to do much more. And B, that the program should be more prescriptive in like what, you know, what levels of affordability are
right.
mandated by area. And I think that's been a demand of community organizers in areas that are targeted for a while.
Like buildings being created in the Inwood rezoning area, more of these multi-story buildings should be entirely affordable housing in the Jerome Avenue rezoning area. For example, in the case of the 30-story apartment complex Sherman Creek North Cove currently in development along 207th Street, all 611 units will be set aside for affordable housing. More complexes like these are being built in the Jerome Avenue rezoning area, such as the proposed River Commons along 168th Street and River Avenue. This complex, revealed by HPD in January of 2022, will hold 278 affordable housing units altogether, along with community centers on the ground floors that will be occupied by Bronx Works, a community support organization focused on assisting residents with housing, childcare, and emergency assistance, and the African Resource Center, which seeks to provide similar services for the growing ethnic enclave. More measures like these would better secure housing without displacement for low-income residents. 421A tax break repeal. 421A is a tax break established in New York City in the 1970s. First implemented in 1971, the 421A tax break was passed by New York City Council with the intention of incentivizing developers to build within the city. This was during an era in which suburbanization and urban decay left New York City with a lack of housing, especially quality housing. In essence, the tax break allows developers to build more stories over the zoning limits if they designate a portion of built residential units to be either affordable housing or a public plaza. Initially, the tax program was not touted as an affordable housing measure, but rather to motivate developers to build at a lower cost within the city. However, in the decades since, affordability requirements have been added in order to continue the program and improve its image among the public. Unlike MIH, affordable units built under 421A are not required to be affordable long-term. Affordability requirements are set by the developers and can be revoked at their discretion or after a certain period. In addition, 421A buildings are oftentimes located in rapidly gentrifying neighborhoods and marketed as luxury units with luxury rents, usually far beyond the market rate. A major issue with this tax program is the fact that history shows developers do not hold up to their promises, getting to build luxury towers at a discount without providing enough affordable units. Said affordable units are typically offered to households at higher ends of the area median income, with some income requirements being as high as 80% of the AMI, starting at around $100,000 per year. This high level leaves out many New York City residents, especially those in the Jerome Avenue rezoning area. Developers have come to rely on this tax break, often factoring it into their building costs and long-term profits. As a result, its continuance persists, essentially acting as a handout to developers while doing little to substantially provide more affordable housing. With its renewal on the table this year, the 421A tax break should be repealed altogether, with those funds being put towards other affordable housing measures like MIH Section 8 vouchers and public housing. Community land trusts. Community land trusts are a smaller scale alternative that seeks to put land ownership in the hands of renters. In their most basic form, CLTs are nonprofit organizations that hold and own land on behalf of a community. From there, the nonprofit allows local residents to develop the land to their desires. Typically, this includes permanent affordable housing, commercial units, community centers, and community gardens. These sites seek to empower residents plagued by the trials of renting by putting ownership into their own hands and not leaving them beholden to a constantly changing market. A long-standing CLT success story in New York City is the Cooper Square CLT, established in 1999 in the East Village, and currently housing hundreds of low-income residents and 22 small business owners with nominal rents. Starting in 2019, New York City has allocated funds for CLTs across the five boroughs as a part of the yearly city budget. In 2021, $1.5 million was dedicated to funding CLTs, and activists are looking to double that number to $3 million in 2022. In the wake of the passage of the Right to Counsel law, the larger priorities of tenant organizers shifted towards CLTs as a way to evade the market now that such a major renter's right had been secured.
The thing that a lot of people are pushing for is community opportunity to purchase, establishment of community land trust. And I think the impetus for that is seeing what the outcomes have been in the rezoning neighborhoods. And also, like, simultaneous with the rezoning was the combination of, like, the growth of private equity. So I think the combination of seeing the outcomes of rezonings, seeing the growing power and reach of the real estate industry and private equity, communities are saying, like, we just have to own the shit. You know, there is no regulation, there is no incentive that can be put in place by the city or the state that will protect us.
Currently, a Bronx-based activist organization is working to establish a community land trust within the borough. Founded in 1974, the Northwest Bronx Community Coalition and Clergy is an organization focused on securing housing rights for residents of the Northwest Bronx. In January of 2020, the NWBCCCC formally incorporated the Bronx Community Land Trust, the first step needed to organize the CLT and develop a site owned and operated by its residents. The NWBCCCC intends on receiving land for the CLT from the city directly, free of charge. And their 2020 report, Fighting Forward, Advancing Development Without Displacement Through Community Land Trust, Shared Governance, and Collective Ownership, the organization identifies 26 vacant or underutilized city-owned sites that could operate as a CLT. Once built, the Bronx CLT would exist as a shared community space with housing and a neighborhood center, fully owned and operated by its residents. Two sites in the organization's report are near the Jerome Avenue rezoning area, leading residents affected to potentially benefit from the project. Vacancy taxes. A recommendation often cited in the political sphere is the use of vacancy taxes. Vacancy taxes would be placed on either commercial or residential units that remain empty for long periods of time, ideally a year or more. Such a policy is especially needed in New York City, where nearly 80% of vacant land is commercial spaces. In commercial corridors, vacant units leave a missed opportunity for increased economic activity and community exchange. In the case of upzonings, when left with a vacant commercial unit, landlords will often purposely leave the unit vacant, in hopes of nabbing a tenant willing to pay a massively hiked up rent. As previously mentioned from observation around the neighborhood, the majority of chain businesses are located at the mouth of the train stations. This is most likely due to the fact that rents are higher where the most foot traffic occurs, thus leaving chain stores as the only tenants better able to pay inflated rents. Another possible concern towards increased amounts of vacant commercial units is the reduction of eyes on the street. The less commercial activity in an area, the less foot traffic and people frequenting a region. Research has shown that in areas that experience large amounts of business evictions and vacancies, crime rates increased. In January of 2019, New York State Senator Robert Jackson introduced a vacancy tax bill into the Senate, which is currently in committee. This bill proposes a 1% tax on the property value of a vacant commercial unit in a city of 1 million or more residents, if the unit has been vacant for more than a year. Such a tax would cut into the profit margins of landlords and developers, and ideally motivate landlords to lease their vacant commercial spaces at lower rents. This would leave room for smaller businesses to occupy storefronts along the avenue, especially along heavily trafficked areas. Commercial rent control. An often overlooked idea, commercial rent control actually has a storied history within New York City. In order to fuel economic development in the post-war years, New York State legislators came up with a solution for struggling business owners. From 1945 to 1963, commercial rent control was in place across New York State. This policy put a cap on the amount of rent commercial renters were charged, allowing for thousands of small business owners to grow their operations without the standard economic pressure of making rent. As recently as September of 2021, a bill proposing commercial rent control was introduced by Brooklyn Councilman Stephen Levin into New York City Council. Currently, between leases, commercial rents can increase as high as 100 to 300% without warning. Businesses that were once viable, or struggling to make rent already, are left with no choice but to close. Along with commercial rent control, other potential solutions are being considered by business owners along Jerome Avenue. According to Kenneth Brown, after issues faced during the pandemic, owners are looking into forming a business improvement district for Jerome Avenue to address their needs and better negotiate with landlords.
Like I said, there was the concern about the robustness of the leases that the tenants have. You know, a lot of their tenancy is a handshake. Now, to mitigate that, we're in the process of creating a business improvement district, which will cover the Jerome area corridor, Grand Concourse, Burnside, Tremont, a significant portion of Community Board 5. So if we can get a business improvement district, that'll afford some protections and amenity. Through the process of the bid formation, we're hoping that, you know, there'll be greater stability and amenities afforded.
With little help received from the city following the pandemic and the rezoning, the structure of a bid would embolden small business owners to establish rights among themselves. In addition, Brown placed a large emphasis on the need for legal counseling.
Another thing that would be very helpful was more access to legal assistance. You know, just having a lawyer or something like a lawyer present during lease negotiations or renegotiations, I think that would be really helpful.
Many business owners, especially those in the auto shops along Jerome Avenue, do not speak English or speak it as a second language. In addition, some business owners may not keep formal bookkeeping and track of finances. Many do not have a formal lease agreement, as stated by Kenneth Brown. When negotiating with landlords and the legal system, this leaves business owners without necessary safeguards. Another possible benefit to commercial rent control is the benefit that comes with prosperity when running a small business. Owners would be able to better maintain and expand their businesses, further boosting economic activity in the corridor.
This is the last stop on this train. Everyone, please leave the train. Thank you for riding with MTA New York City Transit.
Conclusion. Overall, the Jerome Avenue rezoning so far has been a mixed bag of results, leaving longtime residents and business owners with more to lose rather than to gain from the changes to the urban landscape. Despite this, major wins like the Right to Counsel Law have been passed, further strengthening tenant rights in New York City. Policy-wise, there is still a long way to go in the right to secure affordable housing for low-income New Yorkers, in a way that discourages displacement and real estate speculation. Ideally, a mix of all the outlined policy recommendations would provide the most benefits to those negatively affected by the Jerome Avenue rezoning. A reform to mandatory inclusionary housing policy, including a more localized approach to how area median income is calculated, would allow units and new buildings to go to residents in the most amount of need. The repeal of the 421A tax program would de-incentivize developers to build housing for the sake of profit, with hopefully less luxury developments with rents offered at beyond the market rate, with limited and impermanent affordable units. The successful implementation of community land trusts in the Bronx would benefit a small number of residents, however allowing those residents to be in control of their own housing and also serve as an important example to tenants and community organizers citywide. The imposition of a vacancy tax on commercial units would motivate landlords to rent out units at lower rates rather than holding out for the highest paying tenant. Lastly, the establishment of commercial rent control policy would protect small business owners from massive rent hikes in between leases and allow them to grow and expand their operations, further contributing to economic activity along Jerome Avenue. Rezonings contain the potential to do good for low-income communities through the creation of housing, schools, parks, and other locations that contribute to social reproduction and a better quality of life. However, safeguards must be put in place by New York City in order to protect people's livelihoods and way of life. More concessions must be made to create projects from rezonings that contribute to the public good. Well-maintained and safe parks, good schools, and quality housings are cornerstones to residents of Jerome Avenue, ones that they hope to see created in the years to come. In addition, the city must work to bridge the income gap between its richest and poorest residents. For residents of Bronx Community Boards 4 and 5, this can be achieved through educational attainment programs, vocational training, and employment programs aimed to get residents into higher paying jobs, ensuring that they have the means to afford increasing costs of living.
Local residents were able to negotiate successfully some benefits, right? They were able to negotiate some changes and some investments outside of just housing. So like economic development, job and training, workforce redevelopment projects.
And one of the primary focuses of the Jerome Avenue revitalization is workforce development. And we have vocational training nonprofits in it. We have Bronx Community College involved in it. We have a Job Corps involved in it. So vocational education, workforce development is really one of the beating hearts of the collaborative.
All in all, Jerome Avenue is a vibrant commercial corridor, home to hundreds of small businesses integral to the lives of surrounding residents and merchants. While the environment is ever-changing, these policies help to see a future that keeps the majority in mind and gives an opportunity for New York City to prove its duty to the millions of residents who call it home.